This audio recording is under copyright protection, all rights reserved. Any duplication, transmission, or broadcast without permission is strictly prohibited by U.S. and international laws.
Good evening. It is a tremendous pleasure to be here and to share with you some things that I've studied and are very dear to my heart. As some of you know, before I got into this business of being a writing teacher, I was a violin teacher. And so actually my primary career for most of my adult life has been teaching music to young children. And so it's been a hobby of mine to collect up information about music because, of course, I feel that it's an important and valuable thing. But many people view today in the world music as kind of a nice thing. It's nice to have music. You feel good when you have music. It's nice to have children who play the piano. It's nice to be able to play the piano. But I would propose to you that music is not a nice thing at all. It is a tremendously powerful thing, and we need to have kind of a shift in orientation about how we look at music because of the tremendous opportunity that it holds. A lot of people who are involved in early childhood education are also involved in music because children so naturally respond to music at a young age. And yet, somehow, it's always looked at as another good thing to do rather than an essential component of an education. I would like to present to you some information tonight that I think will cause you to shift your idea about music as being really an essential component, and in some cases possibly one of the most important things you can do for the education of your child, particularly during the first 6 to 8 years of their life. One of the types of research that I have gotten into is involves how scientists would measure the effects of music on living things, on people, on children. And one of the researchers who I am particularly interested in is a woman named Dr. Frances Rauscher, who currently teaches at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. And I'll be presenting to you some of her reports today. But to step back just a little bit, I think we can go back in history and think about music in kind of a different way. 100 years ago, the world was a very, very different auditory place than it is today. Today, we live in a very auditorily polluted environment. In fact, if you were to close your eyes at any moment of the time during the day, almost any day of your life, and just listen, what would you be hearing? You would be hearing perhaps the noise of the traffic. You would be hearing perhaps the refrigerator or washer or dryer. If you were in a room where fluorescent lights were, you'd be hearing the buzz of the lights, the heating system. You would be hearing almost a constant state of buzz going on. And if you were to compare that to 100 years ago, it would be very different, because 100 years ago, what would you hear?
Silence.
It would be silence punctuated with the chirping of birds and the maybe clip-clop of horses, the creaking of a wheel. The sounds would be much more discreet and clear compared to the very vibratory world we live in today. Another thing which has changed very dramatically over the last 100 years is what music is to most people. 100 years ago, if you wanted to hear music, what did you have to do? You had to either go find someone who could play some music and get very close to them, or you had to learn to play music yourself. Today, if you ask the average person about music any question, what would they immediately think of? Probably the CDs that they wanted to buy, or that they had, or that they liked. So really, in essence, we've moved very significantly from being music producers as a species on Earth to music consumers. This means that we have less and less control about what we are taking in, about what we are absorbing. And on top of all the buzzing, if you go anywhere to, say, the supermarket or Kinko's or a restaurant, what are you forced to hear? The music of their choice. And it's unlike your eyes, which you can close to avoid seeing something ugly, it's virtually impossible to close your ears. So therefore, we have less control not only over the vibratory nature, but also of the musical environment we live in. This is a very significant handicap to us in the world today. In fact, we're seeing nationwide an increase in what would be labeled things like auditory processing disorder or attention deficit disorder or attention hyperactive deficit disorder. And there are many different labels for problems that children are having, which seem to either be newly discovered or newly developed in the last many decades. And there's an interesting reason as to why sound may be well connected with the neurological function of human beings. I'd like to show you a diagram here, which I cannot really take credit for. The person who first showed this to me is a neuroscientist by the name of Dee Coulter. She teaches at Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. And she created this diagram to explain to us some observations she had made about how children with problems, whether it be autism or auditory processing disorder, how some children like that may be affected by the world they live in. As you see, and think for a moment, a baby. A baby is born, they're born into the world, and they really do not recognize many sounds. They may recognize the sound of their mother's voice, possibly even their father's voice, but they really have no meaning attached to anything. They live in the world of vibration, where sounds exist, but they have no particular meaning or importance, right? Then a baby begins to associate meaning with tone. The creaking of the door means someone is coming. The jingle of keys. It's been shown that children as young as 5 or 6 months can identify their mom's keys as opposed to someone else's keys. The sensitivity of a young child is truly remarkable in how quickly they can differentiate very, very fine differences between tonal patterns and sounds. So as a child moves from the world of vibration into associating meaning with tone, they then become receptive to language. For what is language? Language is simply a combination of tones. If I were not speaking English tonight, if I were speaking Korean or Swahili, which you did not understand, you would not be hearing words, you would be hearing tones. High tones, short tones, long tones, soft tones, louder tones, punctuated tones, lots of different sounds. And were you to study the language, you could gradually associate meaning with those sounds. But initially, it would simply be tone, you see? So tone is the bridge between the world of vibration and the world of language. And why is that important? Because language is what allows us to have meaning. It allows us to transfer ideas. It allows us to attach meaning to things and combine ideas. In fact, meaning is what makes us very different from all other creatures. We can think. And the interesting thing is that without language, it's very difficult to think. Historically, all of the cultures which have had low developed language also had very low developed technology and art and culture. Whereas the most sophisticated language cultures have had the most sophisticated cultures of science and art. So what we see is that the ability to use language is, in fact, the ability to think. Now, there are some people who cannot talk, and a very interesting movie, of course, you've probably seen The Miracle Worker by Helen, about the life of Helen Keller, how she was completely unable to relate to the world around her, and then what was the magical moment? that changed her from being an insane animal to a person. It was when she got the water and got the symbol and the language was connected with the idea and that opened up the whole new door. And of course, Helen Keller became one of the truly most remarkable human beings to ever live, writing voluminous amounts of fascinating stuff, being blind and deaf and dumb. So we see then that this diagram shows how a normal child will begin in the world of vibration through tone, able to detect language. With language comes meaning, and with meaning comes thought, which is reasoning, hearing things inside your head. We think in words, pretty much. And it's very interesting to watch young children. Perhaps some of you live with a 2 or 3 or 4 year old child. Do you notice that they're constantly talking to themselves? Just babbling on, oh, my car's going up, now my car's going down, vroom, vroom, stop, go. You know, and the girls, oh, it's very nice, it's such a good dress, don't you love it? And they're constantly talking to themselves. Why? Because children need to learn how to hear what they are thinking through the pathway of language. And some of us actually may talk to ourselves from time to time. I think having passed over the 40 mark, I may be heading more and more that direction, because when we have a difficult thing to think through, we may actually verbalize those thoughts so we can hear and reason more effectively. Does this make sense so far? Now, why is it important? Well, in a world where vibration is now unnatural, where it's clogging up or confusing the environment that a child would grow up in, they are not able to hear so clearly the discrete sounds that they can then attach meaning to and then develop their language skills. And so this barrier of auditory pollution in the world is making it very difficult for some children to get to the core of what being distinctly human is, and that is to have rational thought. So, we can't unpollute the world. That's virtually impossible. But we can use certain techniques to help overcome the detriments that we're suffering today. I had a very interesting experience when I first got into the field of early childhood music. It was about 14 years ago, I would guess, 15 maybe. I went to a teacher training workshop of Kinder Music, and some of you may have heard of Kinder Music, I don't know. But I went to a Kinder Music teacher training workshop, and the teacher, who was the founder of Kinder Music and one of the most remarkable teachers I've ever met, had a class of about 12 children between the ages of 4, 5, and 6. So they were preschool age children, and for the most part, all the children were joining in, and she had them, you know, dancing with scarves and playing drums and doing different kind of singing and vocalizing activities, except for one boy who was simply not playing the game. He did not want to dance with scarves. He would not play the drums. He would not even stay in one spot for more than 1 second. He was bouncing off the walls of the room. He was tugging on the teacher. He was talking all the time. He was making a horrible mess of the class, as far as I could tell, because it was very distracting, I thought, to all the other children. Well, it's very interesting because the teacher, who is truly brilliant, did not allow that to interfere with her class. Now, if I'd been teaching, I would have just kicked him out, said, this is a discipline problem. The kid has not learned how to sit down and be quiet. But the teacher did not do that. She kept him in the group, as disturbing as it was. And what happened was so amazing. She got to a part in the lesson where the focused listening occurs, right? And that's where you take a tape player and you put on a tape, and for about, 90 seconds, you have the children just sit still and maybe close their eyes, but just listen to the music. And so we got to the focused listening, and she said, okay, children, I'll come sit down here. I'm going to play something for you to hear. And of course, this little boy was over on the other side of the room, right? And he was not at all interested in coming down and sitting with the rest of the children. But when she pushed the button, on came the music. Now, the piece of music was The Flight of the Bumblebee by Rimsky-Korsakov. Perhaps some of you are familiar with this piece, but it's extremely vibratory. Rimsky-Korsakov wrote it to make the string section sound like a bumblebee. And it was amazing because as soon as the music on, this little boy, whose name was Reza, even his name was highly vibratory. He rushed over. He came down. He pushed through this group of children. He put his face right in front of this tape player and sat there motionless for the whole 90 seconds or however long it was. And as soon as it was over, what do you think he said? Can I hear that again? Why? Why was this the magical thing for him? Poor little Reza, who was bouncing off the walls, unable to process things like other children, was so stuck in the world of vibration that he couldn't get to the language or meaning of things very easily. But when that flight of the bumblebee came on, it was the perfect bridge between vibration and tone. It was precisely what he needed neurologically to fill in the gaps in his experience and his problem. And you can imagine what that little boy would grow up to be like in first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade. It would be probably get all number of labels, probably drugged, possibly even sent off to special ed. And yet, he needed that particular area of development that the music could provide. So that was a very, very dramatic experience in my training because I realized, number one, that not all kids are discipline problems, and number two, that the music has a power to bridge into the mind unlike anything else. So I give credit to D. Coulter for this diagram because I think it helps us understand certain things. But Dr. Francis Rauscher, who did some of the experiments that I'd like to tell you about, was very, very curious to know what would be the effects on people of music that could be measurable from a scientific standpoint. Now, Dr. Rauscher is a behavioral psychologist, and so she is able to analyze the behavior of people, and she's very well grounded in testing of IQ and responses and things like this. Well, Dr. Rauscher began an experiment some time ago with some college students. She wanted to know if music could positively or negatively affect the intelligence of college students. And since she was teaching at the University of California, Irvine at the time, she had an abundant supply of college students to test. So she got some college students and she began to give them what she would call spatial temporal IQ tests. That doesn't mean too much to us because we're not the people who use them, but let me describe the test to you so you can get a feeling for it. Have you ever folded up a piece of paper, cut around the edges, and unfolded it? Right? So you make the snowflake effect. Well, this particular test had to do with looking at a folded up, cut around the edges paper versus the unfolded version. And it was a multiple choice timed test. So you didn't have time to sit there and, you know, count every little incision. You had to look and make quick spatial temporal judgments. So she took the students and she tested them one day with no music at all and then logged their scores on this particular test. And then she tested them another day after listening for 10 minutes to either the music of Mozart or some relaxation music, which would be the equivalent of what you might get on a hypnosis tape, you know, very calm, tranquil, and then no music at all, a silence group. So the three different types of music, and she found that, and she did this over many days, she found that the students who listened to the Mozart, and it happened to be the double piano sonata in D major of Mozart, which is a very complicated piece, very, very complex, did perform much better. In fact, 8 to 10 IQ points worth of change in their measurable scores, whereas the relaxation music and the silence group did not show any change from day to day. So this got Dr. Rauscher really a little bit of notoriety and some more funding. because the scientists have to show some results, so she got some more funding, and then she began some other experiments. Another experiment which she did had to do with preschool students. Now, this experiment was very interesting because she conducted it over a 6-month period of time and used groups of 20 preschool children at a couple different preschools, and she brought into the schools teachers who would do supplemental after-school activities for the children for 20 minutes a day. One group of children had free play. That sounds like the best, doesn't it? Another group of children had singing. Another group of children had computer. Now, I'm not quite sure what you do on a computer with a 5-year-old, but that's what they had, some kind of computer activity. And another group had piano lessons, keyboard instruction. Now, all the variables were the same, the adult-to-child ratio, the number of minutes, the actual physical space in the environments, everything was very tightly controlled. And it went on for 6 months. Well, now, after 6 months, she gave them another test. Well, I should describe the test. It's kind of cute. It's, again, a spatial-temporal test, which really has nothing to do with hearing. It was much more a visual type of evaluation. Can you imagine a camel cut up into 4 segments, a little picture of a camel cut into 4 segments? And then the test would be how quickly the preschool child could put back together the camel so that it looked like the original. And so there were many little puzzle-like things for the children to do. So she tested them at the beginning, gave them 6 months of supplementary instruction, and not a whole lot, 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week for 6 months, and then she gave them the test again. Now, of course, everyone would improve because they're getting older, right? So you would expect everyone to get smarter as they get older. But one group improved so dramatically as to be almost stunning to all who were involved in the research. And that was the piano group. The computer and the free play and the singing group pretty much had the normal projected increase, whereas the piano group had a 43% increase in 46% increase in their raw spatial temporal IQ scores. Now, what does that mean? Well, one thing it means is that piano isn't just nice, because they could play the piano, yes, but I might rather be playing or on my computer. However, the piano did something to their brains that transferred to an entirely different activity and actually increased their intelligence. Why? That's the big question. Why? Now, when we think about how the brain works, some of you may or may not be familiar with how the brain works. I've got a little diagram here of a couple brain cells. Looks kind of like aliens from outer space, doesn't it? But that's a drawing of what a brain cell or a neuron basically looks like. There's two of them there, and they have that nucleus, and then they have that one long tail calling out, and that's coming out. That's called an axon, and then they have little dendrites growing out. And basically, the way the brain stores information is that it receives a sensory input, which sends an electrical impulse to the neuron, which travels through, and then it goes into what we would call a synapse, or a place where the end of one axon connects with the dendrite of another. It works kind of like this. If I were to pinch you, you didn't shout. I thought I pinched you hard enough. Anyway, if I were to pinch you, right, you feel that, right? The energy goes from the spot where you received it all the way up to your brain, and it causes a little neuron to fire, right? And it makes a connection with another little neuron, right? And if you get pinched enough in, say, the first few months of your life, that neural connection happens so frequently that the axon and dendrite actually makes a permanent connection. Therefore, you don't need me to pinch you again to know exactly what it feels like. You've stored that information. Does that make sense? There are three ways to store information in the brain. One is with intensity, another is with frequency, and another is with duration. I will give you an example of these three. Let us say, for example, I would like to teach you the Japanese word for toilet. All right. I want to teach you this word for some reason. It might be a good word to know if you're in Japan, right? So I say to you, I'm going to call you up, all right, three times every day for the next 2 weeks. And I'm just going to remind you that the Japanese word for toilet is benjo. All right? So I'll call you back in a couple hours and tell you again. And I were to do that, say, three times a day for a couple weeks. Do you think you would have a pretty good memory of that word for quite a while? That would be frequency, doing it a lot in a short period of time. Another approach would be for me to say, come to your door every week for 10 years. Knock on the door and say, good morning, just wanted to remind you the Japanese word for toilet is benjo, right? At some point, you'd know it for the rest of your life. And it might not take all 10 years. Another way would be for me to say, I'm going to teach you something. And if you remember this 1 month from now, I'm only going to tell you once, but if you can remember it 1 month from now, I will give you $1 million tax-free. Are you listening? That would be an example of intensity, right? The intensity of the need to have the information would seal it, and your neurons would connect up. Now, the beautiful thing about the brain is that it is so incredibly complex and connected up that there are billions and billions of neurons all connected up. And that's actually how we think. A person who has more neurons connected is likely to be more intelligent than a person who has fewer neurons connected. And of course, we hear tragic stories of children locked in closets for the first 7 years of their life, and they can't ever learn anything for the rest of the time. Why? Because 85% of all the neural connections that you will make in your life happen in the first 6 years or so. So really, by the time you're six, you're pretty much cooked. Then you've got another 6, 7, 8 years, and you'll get another 10%. And everything after that, really, is using the connections that you have, rather than making new connections. That's why the first 6 years of a child's life are so exceptionally important. Now, why the piano? We've got to get back to this. Why was the piano so effective when compared with other seemingly equivalent activities? Music is the only thing that stimulates multisensory information at the same time, stimulates the brain in a multisensory way with the same set of perfectly ordered information. You see, music is mathematical. Music is perfect. There are no exceptions to the laws of music like there are to English, right? Music is the highest form of communication because it is so perfect. In fact, did you know, how many of you play the piano? If you play an A on the piano, do you know how many vibrations per second it gives you? 440, right? 440, that's the A that you tune to for an orchestra, right? That's how fast that string is vibrating, right? 440 vibrations per second, right? Now, here's what's really interesting. If you play the next octave up, right, you get the higher A. A, right? Guess how fast that string is vibrating? 880. Now, if you played the next one down, what would it be? 220, and if you kept going down, it would be 110. You see, vibration is mathematically perfect. Music also is, because It has a scale that is very clearly regulated. Now, when you play the piano, you're doing a lot more than just playing the piano. You're seeing a set of organized information, either on the notes or on the keyboard or both. You're hearing that same set of organized information, and you're feeling it tactile and kinesthetically, that same set of organized information. You're getting all three of the major sensory input pathways to the brain stimulated simultaneously with the same set of perfectly ordered information. And what that does is it creates a tremendous neural network, because those neurons are connecting up in all sorts of complex, sophisticated ways. It's like actually practicing the piano is boosting your RAM. Right? Now we have to have a computer with however many gigabytes, right? We've got to keep adding more RAM constantly because the programs they keep selling us get bigger and bigger and bigger. But when you grow your brain, you are adding RAM to the computer that God gave you. And it's very exciting because the understanding here of the multisensory nature of music and the perfection with which it's stored is very way to organize the brain in an orderly fashion. Organization is very important. And when we talk about children who are neurologically handicapped, we will say neurologically disorganized, neurologically dysfunctional because of the disorganization. And so a little bit of understanding of how your brain works helps you to understand the research. And it also helps to explain why Dr. Rauscher found that those preschool children did so much better. Because yes, you could finger paint and you could see and feel, right? You could sing, right? And you could maybe hear, and I don't know if you saw notes or solfege signs or something. But or you could look at the computer and you could punch buttons and see what comes up. But none of those are perfectly organized sets of information. But only music has all three senses. It's like having all of your pistons firing, right? More power. So when you go home and practice your piano, tomorrow you don't say, "Oh, I've got to practice." No. You say, "It's time to grow my brain. Yes!" And those of you who have your children playing musical instruments, and piano's not particularly magical, but for those of you who have your children playing instruments, you need to know you're not doing that because it's a nice thing. You're doing it because it is the single most powerful thing you can possibly do to help that child become a more intelligent human being. And whether they continue into adult, teenage years or adulthood doesn't matter at all. Because whatever you do when they are young is what establishes the neural network that they will live with for the rest of their life. So don't sit around and say, "Oh, well, let's wait and see if he shows any interest or talent," right? "Oh, he's 11 years old. Now maybe he could handle the piano lessons." No, he's 85% cooked by then. You want to get the earliest possible experience. Now, I might mention the experiment with the college students when they improved their IQ scores by listening to Mozart. That effect disappeared after a few days. It was a very temporary effect. It was a fine-tuning, so to speak, because they're already grown. Their brains are pretty much organized the way they're going to be, and that music was giving a little fine-tuning. So on your way to take the SAT, it wouldn't hurt to listen maybe to a couple Mozart tunes on the way. But the experiment with the children is going to have a much more lasting and permanent effect because of the malleability of the children and their brains. Now, other researchers have also been interested in how music affects humans' attitudes and experience. And you all know that music affects your emotions. If you're not convinced, imagine watching a movie like the Titanic without the soundtrack. It would be so dumb. Actually, it was kind of dumb anyway, But it would be even worse because the music wouldn't be there to suck you into the emotion of it, right? So we know that music is very, very powerful. The question was, does different music have measurably different effects? Some researchers who did a little bit of research on attitude got together and tested four different types of music to see if it would have an attitude response. And this were questions that adults would answer. What would you do in a certain situation? How would you feel if this happened type of question? So it's a very, very experiential, empirical survey. What we see is that there are four types of music tested: classical, new age, grunge rock, and designer music. Now, I'm not exactly sure what the grunge rock was, but you would guess it would be something fairly violent sounding by that nature. Now, new age would be something kind of like Enya or George Winston, that type of feeling, right? And then, of course, designer music is what they were actually doing this whole experiment about, which was, could you create music that would intentionally evoke positive responses in people? Well, we see, and I don't know how well you can see it from where you are, but the categories are caring, mental clarity, relaxation, vigor, those are the positive, and then hostility, fatigue, sadness, and tension, those are the negative. So we see that the classical music, and we don't really know exactly what it was, had a slight increase in relaxation and vigor, and a slight decrease in hostility, fatigue, sadness, and tension. We see the new age music had a very mixed response. It increased the relaxation and decreased the hostility, but oddly increasing fatigue and sadness. We see the designer music was doing precisely what it was designed to do, to increase the four positives and to decrease the four negatives, which was exactly the opposite of what the grunge rock did. It decreased the clearing, mental clarity, relaxation, and vigor, and significantly increased, I mean, look at the chart, hostility, fatigue, sadness, and tension. So, no, we also don't know what type of people were taking the test, right? It could have been people who particularly liked designer music and particularly didn't like the grunge rock. So there would be an element of preference in there. Still, very interesting study to show that you could create music that would have a desired response. Another fascinating thing that people have been studying for a while is how music can affect plants. There's been many, many experiments, and I've even had some of my writing students, after coming to my writing class, go off and do their own experiments of this, and so you could reproduce it very clearly. But the most well-known one is reported in a book called The Secret Life of Plants, and it was conducted by a woman named Dorothy Retallick in Colorado. Dorothy Retallick, back in the 70s, wanted to know if music would affect plants, how tone would affect plants. So she took some three groups of plants, and she raised one group with the classical mix, you know, Haydn, Mozart, Vivaldi, Brahms. Another group she put on to various types of rock music, either the rock music radio station, or she did a mix with Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, and Vanilla Fudge. These were, I guess, popular groups in the 70s. And, of course, she found that the plants exposed to the classical music grew taller, faster, had more fruit, were healthier, required less water, had a positive response all around compared to the normal plants, which were in silent chambers. And, of course, very sadly, the plants listening to the Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin type of music, they grew tall and then they withered, and most of them died. You can kill plants with music if you use the right kind. You can also increase plant sounds. There's a whole company out called Sonic Bloom that is actually marketing products to help you grow your plants better with music combined with sounds of nature and some nutritional products. And they have big advertisements of, you know, great huge cantaloupes and 12-foot corn and all sorts of things. So they've definitely got into the marketing of the thing. But it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people say, well, music is neutral. It's just the words that matter. You know, and of course all those, you know, evil rap and rock music that's all, you know, bad words, getting people depressed. Of course that's bad, but it's the words, the music itself. However, the plants don't hear the words. Except maybe the corn, they have ears. They are simply responding to the vibrations, right? And so it's very interesting. Now, we are not plants. We're far more sophisticated creatures. We're mammals. And it's okay to play really bad music to plants and kill them. You've got no horrible moral, right, culpability if you kill your plants. But if you were to intentionally do something that you thought might harm a human being, that could be a problem. And that's why most scientists, when they need to test out products and theories, will test them first on other animals, which you can kill with only a little bit of guilt, like mice or rats or lab creatures, all the way up to chimpanzees, right? So Dr. Rauscher, well, actually before Dr. Rauscher, actually a friend of mine, Dr. Harvey Bird, did an experiment way back in, I believe it was the mid-80s at Farley Dickinson University in New Jersey. Dr. Bird was a professor of biochemistry, and he was working together with another professor in biology. And they wanted to see if music could actually physically alter the neurons of a mouse. So they got a group of mice, musculus to be precise, and they raised one group of mice listening to Strauss waltzes, right? You know waltzes, da 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 dum, bum 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 bum, right? And then another group had no sound at all, and then another group had what Dr. Bird called disharmonic, non-rhythmic drums. Now that is, I guess, a politically correct term for voodoo drums, because what he actually used in the experiment were recordings of voodoo ceremonial drum beats. But you couldn't go publishing that too big, or you'd be guilty of stomping on someone's religion, which would be bad to do in the academic world. So he called them disharmonic or arrhythmic, right? So he raised them up, and a few interesting observations. One thing he found was that the Strauss waltz mice didn't seem to have any behavior different than the silence group, that the music did not affect their behavior in any observable way, but the drumbeat group actually became very violent and began to attack each other in their cage. And so at a certain point he had to stop the experiment and separate the mice because they were really getting pretty violent. So that was back in the days when you could sacrifice the mice brains without anyone getting too upset. And Dr. Bird and Dr. Schreckenberg did indeed sacrifice the mice. And he published a paper, which I will give you the references for all the papers and all the information on a handout later tonight. But he published a paper, and in it were the diagrams of three neurons. Now, I don't know if you recall the other drawing I had of the human neuron. This is the drawing of a mouse neuron. It's actually a camera lucida, which is a filtered photograph, in essence. We see in figure one a normal mouse neuron, a brain cell of a mouse in the control group. Then it's growing out, looking for ways to connect up with other things in a pretty ordinary fashion. If you look at the second figure, you see then that this neuron has a much more orderly and symmetrical quality to it, doesn't it? If you compare the two, I think you could agree that the second neuron seems to know what it's doing a little bit more. It's more almost artistic, if you will. The third neuron, however, was a diagram or a picture of the disharmonic group, the drum beat group. And there you see that this neuron is growing out crazily in all directions, just reaching for something to connect with. And so it is actually a very pathological type of growth. And the neural growth was so pathological, in fact, that it looked precancerous in its abnormality to Dr. Bird and Dr. Schreckenberg. So they did, in fact, quite show that you can affect neurobiologically, neurophysiologically, the brain of an animal by the sounds that it grows up with. Now, that experiment, along with a few others that were done by the Soviet Union in the 80s with music, kind of became a foundation of research upon which some of these more recent experiments have been done. Now, Dr. Rauscher, also the one who did the experiment with the college students and with the preschool students, was also curious to see if music could significantly affect the performance of mice. This experiment showed it affect their brain structure. She was curious to know how it would affect their behavior and performance. So Dr. Rauscher got three groups of mice, and she started this one before they were born. She wanted to get the very earliest neurological age. So she actually began playing the music from 20 days before the mice were born. So they were hearing it all while they were becoming little mice. And then when they were born, they heard it for 60 days after that. So a total of 80 days, which is what, about 12 weeks or so, right? So basically, for the whole period from pre-birth up to maturity, these mice heard music 16 hours a day. The volumes were equivalent. All other conditions, of course, were kept the same: temperature, water, food, everything. And one group had the music of Mozart. She used, in fact, the string divertimentos of Mozart. And so they listened to this 16 hours a day. Another group had white noise. This would be kind of a staticky sound, like if you had your television on a channel but there was nothing there, it was just that static. White noise is used by scientists to cover up all other noise. So it's actually more silent than silence. And sometimes it's used to treat insomnia as well. The third group had the music of a composer named Philip Glass. Now, Philip Glass is what you would call a minimalist composer. He's in a category of John Cage. He's still alive today. And his music is what you might call very repetitive. In fact, I thought I would just play a little bit of the music for you so you could kind of hear what those mice were hearing as they were being born and growing into adulthood. So first, let's hear a little bit of the Divertimento in D by Mozart to kind of tune up our brains here. That this music is very complex. There's complex melodies. There's patterns which repeat and then change. There's harmonies, a very deep level of harmony from very high to very low. And there's a lot of things going on in that music simultaneously. Many people feel, in fact, that Mozart's music is perhaps the most complex of all music that is written. And Dr. Rauscher was a music major as an undergraduate, and so she chose the Mozart specifically because she wanted to choose something which was very, very complicated. And then she chose the Philip Glass because she wanted to choose something that was in stark contrast to that. This is from Metamorphosis 1 by Philip Glass. ¶¶ does happen, actually. You just have to wait a bit. I wish I could say that it changes a little bit more than this, but that's about it for the whole time. As you can see, there is a highly repetitive quality to that music. In fact, it was the most highly repetitive music that Dr. Rauscher could find. So she had the three groups of mice, the Mozart-raised group, the white noise or control group, and then the group with Philip Glass. And she ran them through a maze at the end. Actually, she didn't run them through a maze once. She ran them through a maze many, many times and measured how quickly the rats could memorize the maze. In other words, get through it without taking a wrong turn. And she found that the Mozart-raised group could memorize mazes twice as fast as the control group or the silence group, demonstrating essentially that you can create little rodent geniuses just by playing music to them. However, what do you think happened with the minimalist music mice? It was pretty sad. They could not navigate the mazes at all. In fact, they would have starved because they simply couldn't get to the food at the end. They were bouncing off the walls, completely disoriented like little mentally retarded zombies. Literally. And it was a sad but true fact that she had shown very clearly that you can create a very high level of performance or a very low level of performance simply by changing one variable, and that is what you listen to. These experiments kind of confirmed what some of us knew, that, of course, music is a good thing, not because it's nice and fun and makes you feel good, but because even just listening to it has a power on the brain. And playing it has even so much more power. It's really quite amazing. So I think you should seriously consider what to do with your young children. You know, in the ancient Greek system of education, there were only three subjects. One was rhetoric, and that had to do with all language and reading and everything, philosophy and everything. The other subject was mathematics and geometry, which was the pure one. And the third, an equally important subject that everyone had to have to be well educated, was music. Those were the three subjects. Now, in our house, we've got history and science and, you know, grammar and spelling and what else do we have? Oh, yes, Bible and religion. And we've got all these things, right, that we've got to do. And then music is just kind of something you can do if you have a little extra time or money on your hands. However, if that's the way you are thinking and raising children, you're missing out on the greatest possible gift that you can give to the mind of your children, and that is a well-developed, organized neural network brought about by continuous exposure to and participation in the right kind of music. Now, another interesting young man by the name of David Merrill, he's, I would guess, about 22 or 23 now. I spoke with him on the phone a couple years ago. He got some notoriety in his young life because of some experiments he did, and he happened to win the Virginia State Science Fair with one experiment in particular, and so he got little blurbs in different magazines and newspapers around the country. David Merrill had studied Dr. Rauscher's experiment and said, well, that's very nice and good, but who in the world would listen to Philip Glass? Right? Oh, by the way, I better play this for you just so you don't get the mistaken impression that all of Philip Glass's music sounds like that. Here's just a little more Philip Glass for you so you can make a good decision on whether you want to rush out and buy his newest CD. This is Hydrogen Jukebox. things need to happen a little sooner, don't they? It kind of pushes your limit of what you can tolerate in terms of repetition. It creates a tension there. Why? And I wish I could say that changes a whole lot, but that whole piece goes on for about 90 seconds, almost a couple minutes, just like that. And so you can feel it when you're hearing it, that it's somehow inimical to your nature. You want something to happen sooner than it does. So Philip Glass is kind of pushing the limits of what one can tolerate. And you notice it's very narrow in its melodic range and its rhythmic variety, very predictable and narrow like that. Now, getting back to our friend David Merrill, he did an experiment not with Philip Glass, but with something that people actually do buy and listen to. He performed a very similar experiment with a couple differences. Number one, he bought already weaned mice. So he did not get them at their very earliest period neurologically. He bought already weaned mice. And he bought standard 10-minute mazes. You can buy these things off the shelf, and it's almost guaranteed that any mouse you get from the lab will go through that in approximately 600 seconds. So he bought his mice, he bought his mazes, and he conducted the experiment for 3 weeks. And he played for one group of mice a selection of Mozart pieces, again, replicating Dr. Rauscher's idea that the complex music would have the best result. Another group, he used just regular silence, whatever ambient noise was in the house they would have heard. And another group, he used something which people do actually buy, some heavy metal music by the group Anthrax. Some of you may be familiar with Anthrax. And this was from their album Stomp 445, I believe is the name of the album. And so David Merrill put these mice in the groups, okay? He regulated their water, their temperature, their space per mouse. Everything was very tightly regulated. He played the music at equal volumes. He even had a volume meter to check that the average volume was the same. And then he tested them each week for 3 subsequent weeks. So there were 4 tests, the initial test, and then the test after, and then the test after 1 week, test after 2 weeks, test after 3 weeks. He ran them through the mazes, and this was what he found. They were listening, by the way, 12 hours a day.
Thanks for listening. Do you have questions or comments? Please contact the Institute for Excellence in Writing at 1-800-856-5815 or visit our website, IEW.com.